Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
A Race with Love and Death, the story of Great Britain's first Grand Prix driver, Richard Seaman. Dick Seaman was the archetypal dashing motorsport hero of the 1930s, the first Englishman to win a race for Mercedes-Benz, and the last Grand Prix driver to die at the wheel before the outbreak of the Second World War. A Race with Love and Death is the gripping tale of speed, romance and tragedy, set in an era of rising tensions where the urge to live each moment to the full never seems more important. It's the richly evocative story that grips from first to last. It's written by the great Richard Williams. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK, the author himself, Richard Williams. Richard, good morning to you.
Good morning, Giles. Thank you for inviting me on the programme.
The pleasure is all mine. Dick Seaman, Richard Seaman, a man who, unless you're a motoring racing aficionado, most people won't know anything about his fascinating tale.
No, that's true. His story kind of disappeared with the Second World War for a variety of reasons. He'd only really had time to just about get into his stride as a Grand Prix driver. My feeling is that had he survived, had there been no war, he would have joined people like Len Hutton and Stanley Matthews and Fred Perry, who were contemporaries of his, in the kind of pantheon of British sporting greats. As it is, he's, you could go out into Oxford Street and ask 1,000 people, if there were people on the streets in London at the moment, if they'd ever heard of Dick Seaman, and the answer would be no. For Stirling Moss or Nigel Mansell or Lewis Hamilton, of course, it would be very different.
Tell me a little bit about his background then, because he came from, is it safe to say he came from a wealthy background?
Oh, yes, he did. He came from privilege, no doubt about that. His father was the director of several Scottish whiskey distilleries, and one of the interesting things I discovered during researching the book, which I spent a couple of years doing, is that people who were directors of Scottish whiskey distilleries at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th centuries became very rich indeed, and had the sort of money to spend that we associate with Russian oligarchs today. So Dick's parents, had a country house. They had a very nice London house in Knightsbridge. They had a yacht permanently on call, which they could whistle down from the west of Scotland with its permanent crew anytime they fancied going to Deauville or Cannes or somewhere. And Dick grew up in that kind of environment, very privileged indeed. He went to a prep school in Broadstairs, then he went to rugby school, one of the leading public schools, and from there he went to Cambridge, to Trinity College.
So where did the interest in motor racing come from? There's a picture of him at what's called the InterVarsity Speed Trials. Was there actually a Cambridge and Oxford Speed Trial, which I think is brilliant?
There certainly was. Both universities had automobile clubs for young chaps whose parents could afford to buy them MGs or Bugattis, and they had events of their own and InterVarsity events as well. Dick, like a lot of... Dick was born in 1913, so he was a boy in the 20s, and, that was a good time for getting excited by speed in all its forms. Fast aeroplanes, fast boats. People were always trying to break speed records in the air and on water and on land. And I suppose cars were the most accessible form of that. So when he was at school, he was already subscribing to Motor Magazine and the Brooklands Gazette and becoming familiar with all the heroes of the generation before him, people like Malcolm Campbell and Henry Seagrave. And when he was 18, and going to university, his parents bought him his first car, which was a Riley 9 called a Speed Model. Nice little sports car. I guess they thought it was probably too slow to get him into trouble. But he went off to see a hill climb at Shelsley Walsh in the Malvern Hills and got the bug. And his first competition was there. He went back and competed in the Riley in a hill climb. And after that, you know, his career accelerated and accelerated. And his only problem really was to prize enough money out of his parents to buy him buy himself faster and faster car.
We're kind of used to, you know, being British racing fans, we're used to the, if you like, the post-war British racing scene because of the legacy of the airfields, which gave us sort of Silverstone, etc. But what was the pre-war racing scene like? And what were the, what were the mates involved?
Road racing was banned in Britain. You weren't allowed to close roads and race on them as they were in on the continent. So, you know, basically Grand Prix racing had started in France. They closed roads from between villages and raced on them. And then in Italy and Germany and elsewhere. But in Britain, that was banned. So you were very limited. You could do hill climbs. You could do what were called trials, which were sort of rather strange events, more like kind of reliability runs, really. They weren't races. Or you could race at Brooklands, which was the world's first purpose-built autodrome in Surrey, which was a rather kind of artificial environment for racing. It was a bit like racing on airport runways with a couple of bankings. Dick was very keen on continental road racing. That was where the glamour and the success was, because of the sort of insular nature of the British racing scene. Really, we didn't have people who competed on the continent so much, although Bentleys had done very well at Le Mans in the 20s, for instance. But in Grand Prix racing, we didn't figure at all. We didn't have Grand Prix cars. We didn't have Grand Prix drivers. And Dick was determined to change that.
And also, of course, when we talk about Grand Prix racing on the continent, there's some great, you know, long gone tracks, but things like the Dieppe Grand Prix and the road races in Italy. But also, apart from being incredibly hairy, the fact was that motor racing was seen as an exhibition of national pride. I mean, each country had their own colours, for example, and especially the Germans took their motor racing very, very seriously indeed.
Yes, they did, right from the beginning. You know, Mercedes won the last Grand Prix before the start of the First World War, for instance. They were a dominant team even then against French and Italian opposition. And then when Hitler came to power in 1933, they began to take it even more seriously, because one of the first things he announced as Chancellor was the motorization project, which really had three prongs. He was going to build the network of autobahns, motorways. He was going to start a project to build something called the People's Car, which became the Volkswagen, of course, which was a car that would be a little bit like the Model T Ford in America, would be affordable to the average working man. So he wanted to get, you know, Germany on wheels, basically. And the third part of the plan was a dominant Grand Prix team. Well, actually, they started two, Mercedes and Auto Union, and indeed they were, in the 5 or 6 years leading up to the Second World War, they completely steamrolled Grand Prix racing. They just destroyed the French and Italian opposition.
Because, I mean, Dick was racing the famous ERA, which was basically a plucky little British competitor, but had no sort of answer to these beer moths. So when did he first sort of catch the eye of the Germans?
Well, in 1935 and 36, he raced in what was called the voiturette category, which was for smaller single-seater racing cars. They were proper racing cars, but they only had engines of 1.5 litres, supercharged. So they were much, much smaller than proper Grand Prix cars. Nevertheless, it was good racing and good drivers could distinguish themselves. He started off with an ERA in 35 and won and spent most of his time racing on the continent. And the voiturette races were often run in conjunction with the Grand Prix. They'd be in the morning and the Grand Prix would be in the afternoon. So the team managers of the Grand Prix teams would see the younger drivers distinguishing themselves in the sort of junior formula, as it were. And Dick began to catch the eye, particularly in 1935. Then in 1936, he did a rather unusual thing. He wanted to make the step up to Grand Prix racing, but he knew that there was no point in doing it, not in one of the German cars. So he decided to stay in voiturette racing for another season. And he and a man called Giulio Ramponi, who was his sort of chief mechanic, they got hold of a 10-year-old Delage, one-and-a-half-litre car, and modified it very, very heavily and lightened it, you know, put all sorts of better components on it and made it faster than the brand-new cars being built by other manufacturers. So he did brilliantly in 1936, won a lot of races abroad, and it was very clear that he was a new talent. And he caught the eye of the Mercedes team, and in particular its celebrated team manager, Alfred Neubauer,
yes,
who was a man who really invented the art of team management. He, you know, invented sort of coordinated pit stops and pit signals and that sort of thing. Very brilliant man. And he saw Dick's talent and invited him to a series of driver trials that Mercedes had at the end of the season. They were looking for a new driver or two. And he, in the course of research, I found in the Mercedes archive the timing sheets from those trials. And Dick was up against young German drivers in this sort of talent contest. And his superiority to the rest of them was so clear that it was obvious that they would have to sign him for 1937.
1937, the cloud, I mean, it's easy to say in hindsight, but, you know, Germany, you know, Germany was coming under, had been ruled by Hitler for a period of time now. Did Dick have any reservations of what was going on? Or, I mean, I spoke to somebody about Neville Chamberlain last week, and the fact was that a lot of the British and the English classes and the German classes, the aristocracy and the upper classes, were quite happy to mingle with each other, and it was seen, you know, now we look at it, you know, through the horrors of Nazism, but do you think that at the time, obviously at the time, Dick just wanted to get a faster car? He was, and there's a picture of him looking very reluctant when he wins at the Nürburgring.
Yes, his primary motivation was to get into the fastest car possible, and he'd gone about that in a very professional way. That's the important thing to remember about Dick, that he was not a kind of millionaire playboy, you know, splashing the cash, frittering his parents' fortune away on fast cars. He took it very, very seriously, which was unusual for British drivers at the time. So when he got a drive in the Mercedes team, that was the fulfillment of a very focused ambition. And it was seen as a great honour for British motor racing that one of our chaps should be given a seat in, you know, in the dominant team of the time, as all the other drivers they had were Germans. But he did have some qualms about it. Like most people of their class, his parents had seen nothing wrong with what was going on in Germany in the early and mid-30s. They saw Hitler as someone who'd rescued Germany from economic ruin in the early 30s. I mean, it really was a basket case. And, you know, by various means, Hitler made it seem like a happier place. You know, British people went on their holidays to Germany, you know, whether to the opera or whatever, they, you know, or to Bavaria, to the lakes and the mountains, and they saw what they imagined was, you know, a country at peace with itself again, prosperous, everybody seemed to have a job, you know, and if you didn't look too far beneath the surface, that's how it was. And to begin with, Dick shared that view. You know, he thought, you know, well, this chap Hitler, he's not doing a bad job. And of course, the German government was bankrolling the Mercedes team for which he was going to drive. As time went by during his 2.5 years at Mercedes, the penny began to drop. He began to see what was really happening. But even to begin with, there were a few qualms, but they were overcome by the very clear advantages that he was being offered in terms of his career.
And it was a winning car. What was the reaction of in the UK to him winning? And did he become, if you like, a pre-war hero? Was he fated in the way that perhaps footballers would be?
Well, it's interesting to look back. I spent quite a lot of time in the British Library looking through magazines and newspapers, trying to get a sense of that. In 1938, he won the German Grand Prix, which was the biggest race of the year at the Nürburgring on a fantastically demanding circuit with 174 corners. And, you know, only the greats won on the old Nürburgring circuit. And he won the German Grand Prix, which was an extraordinary thing, and was slightly discomforting to Hitler's sports minister, who had wanted one of the Mercedes team's German drivers to win. So he had to endure God Save the King being played over the PA system to the 300,000 crowd. 300,000 people turned up at the Nürburgring to watch that race. And, of course, when Deutschland über alles was played to salute the winning Mercedes team, you know, they all made their Hitler salutes, as they did at, you know, every opportunity in those days. And Dick, there he was on the winner's podium, surrounded by people, you know, sticking out their right arms. So he did what the England football team had done, you know, a year or two earlier, playing against the Germans in Berlin. They'd been told by the ambassador that it was only polite, you know, to go along with this German salute. So he did that. But the pictures, as you mentioned, the pictures of that ceremony show that his salute was an extremely half-hearted effort. You know, you could tell that, and he had a rather sheepish look on his face. You could tell that his heart wasn't in that.
I'm looking at it already. It is sort of like, yeah, almost like he's hailing a cab sort of thing rather than
exactly
a straight arm salute.
Yeah, that's exactly it. But the reaction back home was interesting. The motoring press and the motoring world thought it was the most fantastic thing. You know, he was the first British driver to win a proper Grand Prix since Seagrave in France in 1923, 15 years earlier, which is a long time. And he won it against absolutely the stiffest opposition, you know, in the most demanding circumstances. So it was a great thing. But if you look at the daily newspapers, there was hardly a mention of it. I think in the Daily Telegraph, there were a couple of paragraphs, and the headline on the piece was that one of Dick's teammates, Manfred von Braukitsch, had been deprived of the win because his car caught fire in the pit stop, and that was the headline, not the fact that this British driver had won the biggest race of the year. So Grand Prix racing at that point was not big news to the general public in Britain. Dick was sort of known. You know, he was a glamorous figure, good-looking, 6'2". So he was known, but he wasn't, you know, on the level of a Fred Perry, you know, who'd won Wimbledon three times. But I think had he, you know, had the war not intervened and he'd carried on winning, I think his success would have done what Stirling Moss's success or Mike Hawthorn or Peter Collins did after the war, which, you know, would have brought Grand Prix racing to the attention of the British public much earlier.
And of course, I mean, how was he reckoned by his peers? Because some of the racing drivers he was racing against, I mean, Nuvolari for a start. I mean, you know, whenever there's a hundred, you know, the best top 10 racing drivers, yep, Nuvolari goes up there, even though this is before televised. I mean, you always get Senna, you always get Clark. but people who are perhaps new to the sport go, who on earth is this sort of little Italian? But also, you know, Stuck, Hans Stuck, you know, the grandfather of Joachim Stuck. And also, you know, Louis Chiron was in there. And as you said before, von Braukitsch, and the man whose name I can never pronounce correctly, Rudolf Caracciola?
Caracciola,
right,
you're going to say.
Exactly, thank you so much.
Caracciola,
yeah,
who was the leader of the Mercedes team that Dick was a member of. And he, Caracciola was into his 30s, but he'd been the kind of, along with Nuvolari, they'd been the two maestros, really, for several years. So, you know, and they were, Caracciola and Nuvolari were as great as any Grand Prix driver has ever been, you know, as great as Fangio or Senna or Moss or Lewis Hamilton. You know, they were fantastic drivers.
And
so he was racing against the very best.
And personally, he took a beautiful young bride whose family happened to be running BMW.
Yes, that's part of the tragedy, really, and it's what gives the story a different dimension. I feel it's more than just the story of a man's career as a racing driver. A couple of weeks before he won the German Grand Prix, he went to a dinner dance in Munich and met an 18-year-old girl. He was 25 at the time. He'd had, you know, several girlfriends, but nothing very serious. But he met this lovely, vivacious girl who was the daughter of the founder and managing director of BMW. Which had become successful since the end of the First World War, making motorcycles and cars and aero engines. So, you know, that was a wealthy family. Dick was living south. They met in Munich. Dick was living about 25 miles south of Munich on a lake called the Starnberger See, where he actually introduced water skiing to Germany during his time there. So he was living quite a nice life with a lovely chalet by the lake shore, and they started going out with each other. And his family got on with Dick very well, and they got engaged. But this was much to the displeasure of his mother. His father had died in 1935. He'd had a weak heart for some time, but it was exacerbated by the stress caused by Dick's racing activities, which he wasn't pleased about. Anyway, he died in 35, leaving Dick's mother as the custodian of the family fortune, which would have gone to Dick on his 27th birthday. But she didn't approve of him marrying a German girl. She wanted him to come home and marry a nice English debutante. So she was very much against the idea of the marriage and cut him off from his inheritance. He was living in Germany, living on his Mercedes salary and the income from a trust fund, but she tried to make sure that he wasn't going to get any more, and it's a great tragedy. They had many rows, and eventually, in the autumn of 1938, they said goodbye to each other for the last time, very acrimoniously. Dick went and got married, a register office ceremony at Caxton Hall in London, to Erica. They were clearly very much in love, and they went off to live in Bavaria. And Erica, his wife's father, gave them a chalet, also under the Bavarian Alps, actually, a very beautiful location near Garmisch-Partenkirchen. So they had 6 months of married life together with no further contact with Dick's mother. Before he was killed.
Now, the run-up to Spa, and as I said before, we said off-air that you've written a book called The Death of Ayrton Senna, which, in my opinion, is one of the great. As I said before, I've read it three times, and when if you see the film Senna, there's a sense of foreboding when you look at the Spa race and what happened and the cars. I mean, we talked about the little ERAs that Dick was racing, but the Mercedes was an entirely different beast, and I use that word advisedly, because if you look at pictures of them thundering around Donington Park, for example, which is a British, the ground shakes literally, because the auto unions and if you're lucky enough to go up and see one of these 1930s Mercedes in the flesh, they're massive. I mean, they are huge, and the cockpit is open. I mean, you could fall out the side. There are no seat belts. The steering wheel is literally sort of seems to be 8 foot across, and the power, it must have been horrendous to put down.
Well, they were brutish machines. They were absolutely the state of the art in terms of engineering and technology, but they were fearsome and still are. They had 600 horsepower in a very light chassis, and no safety measures or precautions whatsoever, either in the car or out of it. You know, the drivers wore cotton overalls. They wore cloth linen helmets. That was a sort of matter of pride, really. They could have worn polo-type helmets, which were sort of hard shell helmets, which amateur drivers in England wore, but the Grand Prix aces disdained that. They just wore linen helmets, which provided no protection at all, just kept your hair out of your eyes. And the, you know, the cars had no fire extinguishers, no seat belts, nothing at all. The circuits, of course, were absolutely lethal. There were no safety barriers. There were ditches, telegraph poles, trees, farmhouses, all kinds of things, completely unprotected. And, you know, in those days, people got killed all the time, drivers and spectators.
And there's a particularly, there's a famous shot of Seaman going around the around at Stavelot, I think it is, the hairpin, which is, you know, he's leading the race. Yeah. All the other drivers have spun off. It's raining at Spa. This is the old Spa, not the modern Grand Prix circuit. But there's also an incredibly poignant picture of him I hadn't seen before of the morning of the race, sort of sharing a cigarette at breakfast with his wife.
Yes, Picture Post, which was a popular sort of news magazine, photojournalism magazine weekly, did a series on people and their jobs. And a photographer approached Dick a couple of days before the Belgian Grand Prix at Spa in June 1939 and said, "Can I come and do a photo essay on your day as a Grand Prix driver, you know, the day of the race?" And Dick said to him, "Well, why don't you go and do somebody more famous like Nivolari or Caracciola?" And the photographer said, "No, it's a British magazine. You know, it would be nice to do a British driver." So Dick said, "Okay." So the photographer turned up at his hotel in the morning and took photographs of him reading Motor magazine in bed, shaving, opening the hotel window and sort of, you know, breathing the air. And then having a last late breakfast, early lunch with Erica, his wife. He was 26, she was 19, he was, you know, he was dressed for the race, he'd got his uniform on under his raincoat. And it's a very touching last picture of the two of them together, as they're just a kind of a young couple enjoying a late breakfast in a hotel on the continent, if you don't know the story. A couple of hours later, he was racing in the pouring rain, hideous conditions, on this very daunting, very fast 8-mile circuit. He got into the lead. Nuvolari and Caracciola, both the great aces, had spun off in the horrible conditions. You know, they were both great drivers on a wet track, but they spun off and out of the race. And he was leading by a comfortable margin with about 11 laps to go. And he approached the end of the lap. It was a fast curve lined with trees. And the car got away from him on the very wet track. He left the track, hit one tree. The car spun round, hit another tree. Banged his head on one of the trees, knocked himself out. The second tree hit the car amidships by the cockpit, which, as you said, was very open. But unfortunately, he was knocked out. And to get out of the cockpit, he would have had to release the steering wheel. Yeah. There was a sort of quick release thing, a detachable steering wheel. But because he was unconscious, he didn't do it. One of the fuel pipes, which ran from a tank in the tail to another tank above his knees, ran along the side of the cockpit. It ruptured and caught fire. And because he was unconscious, he couldn't get out. And, you know, the flames went up. There was no marshal anywhere near. And it took some time before, you know, officials could get there, for another driver whose car had retired came along and tried to get him out. And eventually they did. But by that time, he was very badly burnt.
What was the reaction in the UK to his death?
Well, he'd often said to his mother, you know, the papers in England don't take any notice of motor racing unless somebody's killed. And that was true of him, in a sense, that, you know, his death was big news. And once again, it's interesting to look back at the reports and see that his friends were quoted about what a great driver he was, you know, in the news stories. But they all also said that, you know, he only drove for a German car, for a German team, because there was no comparable English team to drive for, and that he would much rather have driven a British car in Grand Prix. All his friends made that very plain. Because we were only, you know, at the time he died, it was only 9 weeks before the declaration of war. So the clouds were not only gathered, you know, they were very, very dark indeed by that time. And, you know, the rather extraordinary thing, he died on the night of the crash in hospital in Spa. A friend of his accompanied his body back to London. And the following Friday, there was a funeral at a church in Knightsbridge, very close to his London home. And all the great and good of British motor racing gathered for the funeral, and the Mercedes team, the manager, and his fellow drivers flew over as well. And among the floral tributes that arrived at the church was a 6-foot wreath of white Madonna lilies with a ribbon round it, and bearing the condolences of Adolf Hitler, along with a large swastika. So that, of course, made the newspapers the next day. It took two attendants to carry this thing to the church. Mm. So that made it seem, you know, as though Dick was, you know, somehow an accomplice of Hitler, which he wasn't by any means, in any sense, really. So that was a bit of an embarrassment to everyone, but, you know, that was what made the papers.
And what do you hope that people will take from the book? I mean, the inspiration, the fact that he inspired a whole generation of post-war drivers, Hawthorne, Stirling, Stirling Moss, etc.?
Yes, very much that. I'd like, in a sense, to restore him to the national memory. You know, he deserves to be thought of as one of our leading sportsmen of the pre-war era. And I'd like to show people that he achieved that through a very professional approach. You know, he wasn't a playboy. He was a serious racing driver. You know, he lived an enjoyable life off the track. He had a good time. He loved jazz. He liked sailing. He liked all sorts of things, skiing. But his approach to his profession was exemplary, and It was his approach that inspired particularly Stirling Moss, you know, who was a very, very professional driver indeed. So those are the things really that I would like people to think of in the future. And I'd just like him to have, you know, I'd like him to be there really in the gallery of national sporting heroes.
The book is called A Race with Love and Death, the story of Britain's first great Grand Prix driver, Richard Seaman. It's by Richard Williams. It comes out on the 19th of March with Simon & Schuster publishing. Richard, it's been a real pleasure to speak to you today.
And you too. Thank you very much, Charles. Most enjoyable.